It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Green Bay hosts the NFL draft at the end of next week, and the community is bracing for hundreds of thousands of visitors over the three-day event.
Some businesses are extending their hours and loading up on extra goods to absorb the surge, while others are choosing to temporarily close to avoid the chaos.
Residents are renting out their houses for hundreds of dollars a night. Hotels seeing big business, though there may be some rooms available.
And local airports and cell phone networks are boosting their capacity.
We're checking in on the work being done ahead of the draft to get the greater Green Bay area ready. Jeff Bollier is business reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, a week away, is everything ready to rock, or is there just a scurrying, frantic level of activity there in Green Bay, Jeff?
The frenzy is on, but we will be ready in Green Bay. I am confident of that. From public safety agencies working together to, as you mentioned, Green Bay Austin Strouble International Airport, to business community and our amusement and entertainment venues as well.
Paint us a picture of the area around Lambeau Field. What is it going to look like during the draft?
Yeah, so the area around Lambeau Field and the Titletown District to the west of it will be largely kind of blocked off, and it'll be 800,000 square feet of football fund right on the grounds. And then surrounding that, though, will be other businesses, other, you know, food truck parks, you know, people doing whatever they can to sort of, you know, help out, whether that's renting their homes to visitors on Airbnb or parking people in their lawns, just like it was at a Packers game.
Jeff, I've been reading your reporting on how local businesses are preparing. You've written basically the equivalent of a novel over the last month or so. There's so much going on there. Restaurants.
Yeah.
Now, they're used to Packer games, things like that. How are restaurants getting ready for this? There's more numbers coming in over the course of the weekend than even a Packer game.
Yeah, so they're prepping as if it is a Packers home weekend. They're kind of leaning on their extra staff for Packers weekends and their experiences for those home game weekends when the entire stadium district is packed, to sort of prep for what they're going to need in terms of staff and also in terms of inventory, because we do enjoy our food and drink here in Wisconsin.
A couple of restaurants right on the boundaries, one expanding operations, one saying, yeah, you can't come in, but we'll sell you some pizza. What are some of the different approaches?
Well, some of it is about that proximity to the draft area, which, you know, businesses like Lodge Kohler are expanding their food and beverage operations into their parking lots. You know, a lot of the bar and grills like Stadium View and Anduzzi's east of the stadium are also doing the same. But yeah, then there are businesses like Chuck E. Cheese or, you know, there's a local hardware store down a couple of blocks south of the draft grounds that they're planning to just close down. Some of that will be that access to those businesses is a little bit hampered or difficult, but also that in all probability, most of Green Bay is going to be focused on that draft area.
Traffic, congestion. Anybody who's been to a Packers game knows you don't leave fast. What is congestion going to look like? What's traffic looking like for this this weekend of draft activity?
So this is going to be one of the big questions that we're still kind of waiting on, you know, because while there's the expectation is 250,000 people, that's over 3 days. It could be that, you know, the same person is counted twice if they attend 2 days. So we're not sure kind of just how big the sheer volume will be, but, the prep is much the same, you know, parking and lawns, rolling out the red carpet and being ready.
Green Bay is getting ready for the NFL draft next week. Jeff Bollier is reporting on those preparations for the Green Bay Press-Gazette, sharing the latest with us right now. One thing in your reporting surprised me, Jeff, how I didn't think about it, is lots of people, lots of attention on this, lots of use of cell phones. How are cell networks getting ready for this?
So they are beefing up their antennas, their systems, so that they can both handle more sheer volume of people, you know, with phones in there trying to send those pictures and videos and share them on social media. But also, you know, for on the business side of things, too, there's going to be a huge demand and a huge need for bandwidth and for capacity on their networks. And so pretty much every provider has requested approval and started some longer ago than others to make upgrades and improvements, adding antennas, adding additional network service systems so that the added volume of people here will be handled.
One of the big questions was lodging. And I remember months ago, local seminars on, hey, here's how to rent out your place for this weekend. How are things playing out now with both, you know, people renting out their personal spaces and hotels 1 week out?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It was one of the things that a lot of people were expecting, and a lot of that, you know, Green Bay has about 5,000 or a few more than 5,000 hotel rooms that, you know, a large majority of those, but not all, were secured by the NFL and its partners, either contractors, you know, business organizations. And so there was a lot of like, where are people going to stay? So, you know, hoteliers know their business. They did not put all of their rooms available out on the market until just a couple of weeks ago, you know, to wait until it was a little closer, because while the community has been preparing for this and working on this for about 2 years now, you know, the draft and football fans, you know, really are looking at the weather and kind of waiting until now to determine whether they want to attend this free event and if it's going to work out for them. So it's been hard to kind of figure out what the demand will be, but there are still, I just checked, and there's about 12 or 14 hotels with rooms available in Brown County and many more in the Appleton area as well. But that always was the expectation also, was that, you know, this was going to be a regional, if not statewide, operation or impact, you know, in terms of needing, you know, people to, you know, people will be finding rooms in Appleton, Oshkosh, Sheboygan, you know, beyond just the Green Bay area. So it'll be good, and we'll see what comes.
One thing I loved in your reporting, one thing that could have been but isn't, people will not be staying at a cruise ship parked in Green Bay.
Yeah, it was great to see the community kind of its imagination and its mind run wild about how to increase capacity and to handle an event of this size. And so, you know, there was an idea of could we dock a cruise ship, which they are coming in June to dock in Green Bay, but for a cruise, not for the draft. But they wanted to, you know, could we bring a cruise ship and add some hotel rooms? Could we, you know, to get more people up here, charter a train, which is a thing, from Amtrak to handle getting more people up here as a showcase for the opportunity or possibility for Amtrak expansion into northeastern Wisconsin. So it was very cool to see just kind of the collaboration and the imagination that the Green Bay Area community has shown in response to this once in a lifetime event.
Anytime a city hosts a big event like this, there's a big question mark in the air about how much economic impact this is going to have. We probably won't sort things out for a bit. What I guess for local leaders, what does success look like?
So that'll be interesting to see. We're not really sure yet. And that's the thing, is that, you know, with this being a free event, it's, you know, everybody is sort of uncertain as to just how big it will be, or just how, you know, just how it will go, what the business impact is going to be. But the general sort of benchmark that we've been talking about and had set a while ago was that the expectation is that this will generate $20 million in the Brown County area alone, which is a little bit more than your average Packers home game, and roughly $94 million statewide. So we'll see how that goes, but, you know, it will It'll take a little time to figure out whether or not it was a success in that way.
That's for the money made over that weekend. Another hope whenever a city hosts something like this is we're bringing new people in and maybe we're putting ourselves on the radar for them to come back, not just for a Packer game, but they love the Green Bay area and they're going to come back and visit. Are people framing it in this way? Like, hey, we're kind of reaching out maybe to a new tourism audience here.
Very, very much so. My colleague Kendra Miner just wrote a story about 11, attractions and places to go visit here in Green Bay. Some of our favorites are some of the more renowned ones, such as Bay Beach Amusement Park, home to Elvis's favorite roller coaster, the Zip It Pippin.
Zip and Pippin, I've ridden that.
Yes, I have too. It's quite a ride. Bay Beach is opening up. Some of the, we're going to have a special Saturday farmers market downtown in the hopes of showcasing some of the food and drink and, kind of experience that that a Green Bay area farmers market is. And also, a lot of organizations are really kind of opening up their doors to draft visitors to show off Green Bay's culture, history, and ties to football, and that'll take a lot of forms from, community support that the NFL is kind of organizing and mustering, but also in the form of things like, the Packers Heritage Trail Living History and Booyah Battle and the Draft City Music Festival in downtown Green Bay.
And Jeff, your colleagues in the sports department, I know where they're going to be watching the stage and who's getting drafted. During the event, briefly, what are you going to be reporting on?
I and my colleagues at the Press Gazette will be on the grounds looking for, what stories are out there, how experiences are going, whether it is living up to expectations and the hype, but also then just, like AirVenture or down in Oshkosh or the Ryder Cup, the expectation is that a lot of visitors are going to just be happy to be here and enjoying a fun festival of football. So it'll be fun talking to them and just getting their stories as much as anything else that happens in the draft. That'll be me.
We'll leave it there. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Rob, thank you for having me.
That's Jeff Beaulieu, business reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette, talking about preparations for the NFL draft coming up next week in Green Bay.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Waupun Prison could become a vocational village under a plan from Governor Evers. Michigan pioneered these programs in the skilled trades.
These programs do make a difference. They give people the necessary skills to be able to go out and find a job and keep a job.
Job readiness after prison, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Evers is proposing an overhaul of the corrections system in his state budget blueprint. He wants to turn Waupun Correctional Institution into what's called a vocational village.
This would involve overhauling the 174-year-old prison building and replacing it with new housing and job training facilities where inmates would learn skilled trades like carpentry, automotive mechanics, and welding.
The country's first of its kind vocational village program started next door to us in Ionia, Michigan. In 2016, the state's corrections department started the system in part to address a workforce problem around the state.
The model has since been replicated around Michigan and in other states. We recently talked with Heidi Washington, the director of the Michigan Department of Corrections, and asked what got her interested in the vocational village approach.
Well, I've been working in the Department of Corrections for about 26 years, including being a prison warden for many of those years. And I was always aware of the education programs that existed within the department. But when I became director, I really wanted to focus on a much more immersive way to deliver education and skills training. And so really wanted to provide something that not only taught high-skilled, in-demand trades, but also taught individuals what it is to be an employee, what an employer is expecting of you. And so the Vocational Village was really built around that, around being the first of its kind skilled trades training center inside of a correctional facility that provides a positive learning community for prisoners, but also teaches them what employers expect of them, which is to come to work every day and put in a full day's work. And so those are just some of the, you know, sort of foundational components of what the Vocational Village was built on.
How do you decide who gets in, who is able to have this opportunity?
The Vocational Village is an application process. And so we're looking for individuals who are within 18 months to 2 years of their release date, so of going home. We ask them to apply and to really state to us and explain to us why they are ready to make this type of a commitment and what they hope to do with this opportunity if they're selected for the program. We also want to be sure that we are looking at what they have an interest in doing and what they have an aptitude for. And we consider all of that in their admission to the program. So we really want to be sure that we're training them in something, that they have a reasonable or realistic likelihood of actually being able to achieve employment in. So Michigan's a very broad, geographically diverse state, I will say. And, you know, we want to be sure that if you're going back to part of our state that doesn't have CNC machining, for instance, that's not the trade we're training you in. So we want to make sure that where you're going and what we train you in, there's an opportunity for you to get a job. And then once you are accepted to the Vocational Village and we've determined that you meet the criteria, you're the right security level, you don't have a significant misconduct history, then you are transferred to the Vocational Village, where part of the model is that everybody lives together in one housing unit. And so we separate the students in the Vocational Village from the rest of the individuals living at the prison. So they go to Vocational Village together, they go to their meals together, they recreate together, and they will remain like that until they are released on parole. And we've found that that is helpful in creating a supportive community within the Vocational Village.
Wow, you really create then a community that is, you know, working together, progressing together, and it sounds like there are built-in support systems there.
Right. Definitely built-in support systems. They are able to go back to their housing unit after those classes are done and take their materials so that they can study. You know, the programs that we offer, they're very intensive. I would say that they're difficult. They're challenging programs, things like CNC machining, robotics, 3D printing, for example. And a lot of them are math heavy. So there's a lot of studying that has to go into making sure that they can master all of the skills. We also have a very robust college program in the Michigan Department of Corrections. And so we often pair our college students in study halls with our Vocational Village students in the event that they need extra support in certain areas of study.
And when you track things like recidivism or the return to prison rate and employment rates for people after their release who have gone through the Village program, can you share some of the outcomes?
Sure. We do have some preliminary data. We've looked at the success of individuals overall in the Department of Corrections, in other words, the recidivism rate, compared to the success of those who have gone through the Vocational Village and completed the program and then been released. And what we have found is that the success for Vocational Villagers is roughly double what the success of non-Vocational Villagers, or I guess to put it conversely, the recidivism rate is cut in half. So recidivism overall in the state of Michigan is around 22%. And the data that we have looked at tracking the Vocational Villagers found that the recidivism rate of those individuals was about 12%. So it's a significant difference, meaning that these programs do make a difference. They give people the necessary skills to be able to go out and find a job and keep a job. So we're very proud of that. And employment rate would be similar. We track overall employment, and then we also track specifically for those who have completed these programs. And overall, those who have completed the Vocational Village have about a 65% employment rate on average. And so we're pretty happy with that number. We're, of course, always striving to get it even higher.
I'm curious about your partnerships with the private sector here. How have companies worked with the Vocational Village? What is their contribution to this?
First of all, without employer partners, we wouldn't be where we are. So it's obviously very necessary that we are constantly developing new relationships with potential employers, because once we've trained these men and women, we want to be sure that they have a job to go to. So we have actually brought on what we call job developers in our department. And these are individuals who are working exclusively with recruiting new employers and then, you know, working with the employers we have to set up interviews, to introduce the students, to make sure that employers know every month who's coming up for parole and what credentials they have. So, you know, we're working with about 750 employers statewide, and we have a regular email blast that goes out to them that's introducing them to the individuals who are seeking work. And it's been just phenomenal to have so many great employers that see the value of this program. And it really has been a benefit for them, because they have large demands to hire skilled people. And we have the ability to be responsive to that and to train them specifically for what employers need.
Here in Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers is proposing a vocational village for our state. And I'm wondering, what should Wisconsin be prepared for if this goes through?
Prepare for creating a program that's transformational, both inside your correctional facilities and outside. And, you know, in addition to obviously impacting the lives of the individuals who are going through the program, it also has the ability to impact the culture of the facility where it's housed. We know from operating three vocational villages now that the individuals who are in this program, they're engaged, they're hopeful, they're optimistic, they are working very hard in a positive pro-social way towards their future, and they are not engaged in trouble. We don't really have any issues within the vocational villages in terms of assaults, misconducts, those types of things. So it's creating a safer environment inside prison. And then it is, you know, creating the opportunity for employers in our state to fill open positions with very talented, skilled individuals. And then most importantly, above all, it is helping people to not return to a life of crime and not to be creating additional victims. And, you know, that's what we're really after. When we can do that, that's when we really achieve long-term public safety for the taxpayers and the residents of our state. And hopefully we can even break the cycle of intergenerational criminal behavior and stop the next generation from coming.
Director Heidi Washington, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Michigan Department of Corrections Director Heidi Washington, who opened the nation's first-of-its-kind vocational village program in 2016. Now we turn to a former participant of the program. Marcos Fernandez is president of Ideal Welding Solutions in Hudsonville, Michigan, and graduated from a vocational village in 2018. Marcos, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You had been in and out of prison, serving around 13 years in all, and you described getting out was like being hit by a brick wall. How were you able to make that brick wall disappear, and what happened?
Having a skilled trade, you know, prior to having a skilled trade and welding, every time I got out, it was difficult to find jobs. For one, is because of the criminal record. For two, not really having no job history. So by being able to, you know, receive the skilled trade, you know what I mean, and actually the MDLC helping me, the vocational village, getting me a job prior to me getting out, gave me a head start.
What do you love about welding?
Welding and fabricating is completely different. It helps you be more creative. You know, you got to have a creative mind to be a true fabricator. You know, I always tell these guys, anybody can weld a bead, but only a true fabricator can understand and problem solve on how to make sure the differences, understand the differences of the metal, what the heat does to it, you know, what it doesn't.
And you graduated from the Village program in 2018. What were the initial steps when you got out of the program?
When I got out of the program, once I graduated and prior to me being released, they already contacted employers and they had employers come in and do like tours. So I knew I had a job getting out. So once I got out, same day I got out, I went and did a well test with this company and I passed a well test and I started that following Monday. Mm.
You didn't have to explain to that company anything, I would imagine, about your background. You just had to demonstrate your skills. You had to demonstrate your proficiency in welding. What impact did that have on you?
Well, it helped out a lot because prior to that, it's like you always have to put down all your whole criminal record. You have to put down everything that you've been in there. Then you got to explain that. The impact is like it gives you more confidence because now they're just looking at you for your skills rather than what you did wrong in the past, the mistakes you made.
Fast forward to today, you're a business owner. Can you tell us about the success of your welding business?
Well, yeah. Well, my welding business, you know, I stopped working at the last company. I just thought to myself, like, I got to start my own company. I got to take my future in my own hands. And it was still a struggle. You know, I sold my house. I went all in with my company and believing in myself. And my first year, I think, I didn't do much. I did like zero in sales. It was just getting everything going because it was difficult to even get a location. My second year after I built the company out, I was able to do 25,000 sales. In my third year, I did 225,000 in sales. Mm. So I jumped up a lot. And by doing that, I was able to purchase another company. So now with my new company, we're doing between $75,000 to $100,000 in sales a month. So it's completely different.
Did you know you were a business entrepreneur? Did you know you had this in you?
I always knew I wanted to start a business, but I never knew what business to start. It was until like I found out that I really had a niche in fabricating. Don't let me mislead anybody. It's been a struggle. But by learning and just keeping on going, just getting up every day and keeping the fight alive is what I look at. It's all about the grind. Mm-hmm. Get up every day. Continue moving. You learn every day. This business is never ending.
I understand you hired a person who's gone on through the Vocational Village program. How did that feel?
It felt really great to give an opportunity back to somebody that went through the same thing. And even with him, like he went from, you know, he worked with Ideal, my first company. And then I am hiring him through my second company. And even with him, it helped him a lot because now he can relate to somebody that's been through what he's been through. You know, he's very, they're like really appreciative. You see the workforce out here is completely different. You know what I mean? Some people that never went through that struggle and some people that have. And with him, he's like very appreciative and I just try to guide him the best I can.
You referred to that struggle and my mind immediately went to someone who is justice involved or who has a background as an inmate. When those conversations come up with your employees, perhaps, how do you handle them?
Straightforward. Everybody knows I got a background. Everybody knows. You know what I mean? And we just try to work through it. We try to work through the problem, you know? And, you know, even being an inmate, and like I went back to the MDLC and I spoke to the guys there, you know what I mean? And I just let them know, like, I've been where you've been at. I know what the struggle is. And at the same time, that everything can be better. You know, if you use your skills to what you need to do, you know what I mean? You're going to be okay.
Well, seeing is believing. You have growing businesses. They can't deny that. You can't deny that. How does it feel to be a motivational speaker to them?
I just thought to myself, as long as, you know, I mean, if I can reach out to one person, and I think that'll be great. You know, when you're speaking, you can see the facial expressions to the people. So some people, like, even in the beginning, some people were like, yeah, whatever. Like, who's this guy? But I think, well, at that point, this one guy that I was actually incarcerated with, he stood up and he was like, I know a lot of you probably don't believe, but I sat right here on a bench with him and he explained to me exactly what he was going to go do. He was like, the business model changed because I was looking at that point as a mobile welding company. He was like, but the business model changed to him doing fabricating and machining. He was like, but his dream was still the same. He was like, so I can actually say, like, I was here with him and me actually seeing guys I was locked up with and coming back to see them again. It was, you know, I mean, it was a wonderful feeling that actually to speak to them and just let them know, like, look, if I can do it, anybody can do it.
Marcos, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Marcos Fernandez is president of Ideal Welding Solutions. It's a metal fabricator in Hudsonville, Michigan. He graduated from a Michigan Vocational Village program in 2018. And earlier, we spoke with the director of the Michigan Department of Corrections, Heidi Washington, who opened the nation's first-of-its-kind vocational village program in Ionia, Michigan in 2016. Governor Tony Evers is proposing a vocational village model for the Waupun prison. That is part of an overhaul of the prison system in his new two-year budget proposal. The program in Waupun would focus on expanding job training.
A new shelter helps homeless families in small town western Wisconsin. Hear the story behind the project and who's at risk.
Their paycheck to paycheck, one upsetting factor would, you know, could cause them to become homeless.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
Listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about connecting with nature as spring emerges.
As winter fades and Wisconsin begins to thaw, the changing season brings renewal, not only to the land, but also to the human spirit. Writer Ron Weber explores how the arrival of spring awakens long-forgotten memories and gives us a chance to rediscover the sense of wonder that often lies dormant within us.
We look forward to it with the anticipation of a child waiting for a midnight visit from Santa. Winter has been long, and though we may have enjoyed all the sledding, skating, ice fishing, and snowmobiling, we are more than ready for its coming. As the snow and ice recede under a sun whose zenith climbs minutely higher with each passing day, we ready ourselves for the season of rebirth. Spring comes with many sights, sounds, and scents, emerging on a once-frozen landscape, awakening feelings and memories, some of which we may have thought long forgotten. For me, the first true sign of spring is the sound of water on the move, whether it be dripping off the big maple in our front yard, flowing down our driveway, or rushing through the stream out back toward Soft Maple Creek, the Chippewa River, and eventually the sea. That sound can be heard both day and night now, though I especially enjoy the soft music it makes at night while the rest of the world is asleep, out there in the darkness, mysterious, beckoning. This is not the mere tinkling of water as Aldo Leopold noted in his January thaw, that awoke a skunk and summoned him out of his den for an evening of gallivanting across the countryside. This sound has an urgency to it, a purpose, a permanence. There is no stopping it or going back. Spring is coming now. A cold night or snowy day, simply an inconvenience. In an instant, I am 10 years old again, following a stick I had thrown in the ditch, swollen with snowmelt or rain, now carrying both the stick and me downstream. Nearing a culvert, I am amazed by the sight of a small whirlpool, which spins the stick crazily and sucks it out of sight and into the culvert. Running to the other side of the driveway, I silently wish that the hand of fate allows the stick safe passage. Sometimes the stick never emerges, but this time it does, and the chase continues. In-stream obstructions slow the progress here and there, but eventually we are moving again. Usually a hungry culvert ultimately ends the journey, though once or twice we made it all the way to the larger creek, a quarter mile or so from my house. Those journeys with the sticks led to all sorts of discoveries and high adventure. An empty beer can in the ditch was fished out and upon inspection revealed a crayfish which had crawled inside. This inspired me to check other cans and eventually to enlarge the hole in the can just slightly to make it so inviting to more and larger crayfish. One year, a particularly heavy snow melt and subsequent rains flooded a field and section of the woods behind our house. We first waded into this ephemeral wonder, but soon figured out the most adventurous way to explore it would be by canoe. And so, for the first and only time, we were sailors on the high seas, expertly guiding our craft through the perilous trees and bushes we heretofore ran through. The snow will eventually melt, the rains will come, and water will again start its journey across the land. Ditches and creeks will swell, carrying their precious cargo seaward. Here is hoping that the young and young at heart still take the time to throw a stick into the flowing water and chase after it. Those lucky enough to do just that may get an education of sorts and find that not only does it fill their day, but their memory as well.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Homelessness is often seen as a big city problem, but rural and small town communities around the state also deal with homelessness.
Community groups in rural Wisconsin work to provide services to people who don't have stable housing, but limited resources can be stretched thin and it can be hard to connect people with the services that are there.
A Western Wisconsin community pulled together to tackle those problems with a new family shelter in Monroe County. The Family Promise of the Great Rivers offers food, clothing, life skills, and community to families in need.
Their new shelter in Sparta opened late last month. They're already working to expand it. Jesse Todd is executive director of the Family Promise of the Great Rivers. Jesse, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I want to start kind of big picture, Jesse. I think when people think homelessness, right, they picture a big city. Can you talk about homelessness in rural parts of the state, in your part of the state?
Yeah, so I mean, it's just as common. It's just as big a problem. We see it present itself a little bit differently. We don't see as many people on the streets, those kind of things, especially with the no camping bans lately. But we see more people doubled up in certain areas. We see them in smaller towns, maybe in their vehicles or kind of away from the mainstream flow of traffic. They'll park on side streets and on back roads overnight to sleep, but it's definitely there.
Who are the families in your community who are maybe riding that line? They're on the verge of being homeless, or they are sometimes homeless, sometimes housed?
The population we generally serve is probably about the families mid-20s to mid to late 30s is real common as far as an age demographic. But all of them have one thing in common. I mean, they have average jobs or I guess more of a common pay. It puts them into a category where their paycheck to paycheck, one upsetting factor could cause them to become homeless.
And I've heard that phrase, ALICE, which is an acronym. I don't remember what it all stands for, but it is that idea you're talking about, of the person who has a job, doesn't pay a lot, one problem puts them in serious financial difficulty. Can you tell us more about that concept of that ALICE category and what you see in your community?
Yeah, I was trying to keep the jargon out of it and you brought it up, but ALICE stands for Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. So these are people that are working. I mean, they're trying, they're making a conscious effort, but because of their limitations on their own assets and their daily income or monthly income, it puts them into a situation where they can't meet what it takes for a living wage. They're falling short each month by no fault of their own. It's just economy versus wage.
And I wanted to dig into that because, again, I think a conception of homelessness is these are people who are unemployed and long-term unemployed. That is not what you're necessarily seeing in the communities you serve, right?
No. I mean, we certainly do have those difficulties. We see, some people with disabilities and those kind of things that have other barriers that do make it difficult. But, a good 60, a good two-thirds of the families we serve are employed and do have some sort of income.
You mentioned what rural homelessness looks like. It might be that person living in a car. It might be somebody alternating between the car and couch surfing or something. Does that make it a challenge to, count how many people are homeless in your communities and to provide outreach and services to them?
Yeah, it's always a challenge to get a good, accurate number. Nationwide, they do a Housing and Urban Development does a pick count twice a year, where agencies go out and count them, and that's always a difficult number to get. They just don't want to be found. They're worried about being hassled or being kicked out because of a no camping ban. But as far as reaching them in a rural area, sometimes it's even more difficult. We have our cities spread out such a broad landscape, and it's hard to get transportation is one of the biggest barriers, hard to get into the bigger city or the county city to receive those services.
We're going to get into the kind of services you provide at Family Promise, but how do you reach out to people? That person who is in that car in a secluded location so they don't get caught sleeping in their car, how do you reach them to even let them know that, hey, you exist, that there's some kind of help out there?
So, yeah, I mean, we broadcast ourselves as much as we can, make ourselves known. Everything from churches to other service agencies, health departments. We have our materials everywhere. We work a lot on referrals. If one department gets someone that applies that maybe they can't help, doesn't fit their scope, they know where to refer to. So we work a lot collaboratively, to kind of catch everybody in this big net. But we also have other efforts where we had our total navigation team meeting, which is multiple agencies getting together in one spot for a couple hours and just being available for walk-in triage. So no matter what you're facing, somebody in there is hopefully going to cover that scope.
We're talking to Jesse Todd, Executive Director of the Family Promise of the Great Rivers. They're in Western Wisconsin. They work on homelessness there. Jesse, one of your newest parts of your efforts are this new shelter. Can you tell us about the project and what it took to make it a reality?
Yeah, so there was a lot of proof of concept that went into it. Family Promise has been around nationally for some time, so that's not new, almost 40 years to be exact. And we started with a rotational shelter in 2019 where families would come in and stay 1 week at each church location. They'd be served by volunteers. During the day, they would leave that location, come to our day center, receive case management resources, and go back in the evening again for dinner and a place to sleep at night. The logistics of that are very, very difficult. It takes a lot of time to organize volunteers, and it's a lot of transportation in a rural community. But we were able to show that we were having a big enough impact. We were serving enough families that we got the support in our community. One of the great leaders of our community, Todd Torkelson, I guess we're influencers, was happy to work with us and help us get this location. It was previously his location, and helped us get it off the ground. And then after that, it's just it's a lot of momentum. I mean, it's a community effort. It's outreach into local government and to other agencies, congregational spaces, community clubs, those kind of things, anybody we can get to kind of help push the effort and fund what we're trying to achieve.
What does having this shelter space now mean for, say, that there's a parent and kid who otherwise might be sleeping in their car on a cold night? What does this shelter mean for them?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously it's warmth and security and, some certainty, a place to stay. But even more so, it's a place to start focusing on rehabilitation, on getting back into an affordable, sustainable living situation. So instead of that night-to-night and that day-to-day worry and that trauma they're going through, they can take a breath and start taking those steps. Our goal is always to get to housing first. People recover and succeed the most when they don't have to worry about their housing. Of course, the housing market's not always easy to get to housing first, but just that stability is huge.
Yeah, you don't want repeat customers. You're hoping to find a transition to permanent housing. What kind of things do you do there at the shelter with the rest of your organization and those partners you mentioned to try to help make sure that that person, that family, ends up in a more stable space?
Yeah, so we work across the board with all kinds of different people, WTC, college, those kind of things. We have people that want to better their employment. We maybe help them with their resume, help them, present themselves in a better way and get better opportunities. But if they have educational goals they want to complete, those kind of things, we may help them find scholarships, find opportunities to be able to do what they wanted to do to get where they want to be. But all of that, and a big part of it is healthcare. 2/3 of the families we work with do have pretty specific healthcare needs that would become barriers to anybody's stable living. So we find them referrals for that, whether it's behavioral health, physical health, chronic illness, whatever it is. And we just kind of help them get that all buttoned up and just get a routine to a more structured situation.
Now, getting back to the shelter, this is the result of an ongoing campaign. You mentioned reaching out, getting that community support. What's next? I assume you're not done building that support and planning for the future.
No, not at all. It's very grassroots. It's not like we get a $1 million capacity grant just to build where we want to be. This is something that we raise a little at a time. Right now, we can house one family. When that family moves out, we can get a new one in. We are literally about $20,000 away from being able to finish our security and dividing up the space a little bit of renovation so we can house up to 3 families. Then again, it'll be another chunk of money. We haven't really looked at the numbers. It should be around 50,000, but then we'll be able to get 2 more dormitories for families. So in all, our goal is to get up to 5 families in our current location.
Jesse, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it was a pleasure being here. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Todd is executive director of the Family Promise of the Great Rivers. The Sparta-based organization just opened a family homeless shelter. World marks Earth Day on Tuesday. The event's driving force came from right here in Wisconsin with Gaylord Nelson, who served as governor and U.S. senator.
On Monday, we'll hear from John Francis, also known as the Planet Walker, for his years of long-distance walks while observing a vow of silence. He'll be back in Wisconsin, where he earned a doctorate for his research on environmental issues.
And we want to hear from you. How do you observe Earth Day? Are you involved in environmental efforts in your community or beyond? Have you ever participated in a walk or march in support of a cause?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us at 888 888- 642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Mackenzie Crummy, and Courtney Everett. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter.
Tim Peterson is managing producer, and Dean Kinetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.